Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to our event, Thinking Big. I'm Julia Vitullo-Martin. I'm a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and I'm director of the Center for Rethinking Development. Everybody in this room remembers very well that Mike Bloomberg was elected mayor in the first election after 9/11. He was elected for many reasons, but one important one is that many lifelong Democrats decided to vote for a man who they believed would have a calming influence on New York after the attacks of 9/11, who would manage the city very well, and who would be an excellent caretaker. Now, in retrospect, this looks rather like what the College of Cardinals did in 1958 when they elected Angelo Roncalli, Pope John the 23rd. Mike Bloomberg has been for us a revolutionary John the 23rd. He has been a superb caretaker of the things in the city that were doing well. He's built on Mayor Giuliani's magnificent crime program. Crime has gone down a further 20%. He's introduced innovations like 311, which is both an instrument of democracy and a very important new accountability measure for city agencies. It works. I know it works. I personally use it all the time. And more important even, and 311, by the way, has now become part of the orthodoxy, so we don't even think of it as revolutionary anymore. Even more important, Mayor Bloomberg began the most extensive rezonings in city history. When the Bloomberg administration began that initial rezoning of Brooklyn in 2003, they did so quietly and calmly that the opposition didn't have time to get together to stop it. It happens in retrospect that 2003 was also the beginning of London's very aggressive competition with New York. So in retrospect, what Mayor Bloomberg has done and his rezonings have done is open up a tremendous amount of property that had lain fallow now to development so that New York will be able to accept the new residents and new jobs that it needs to remain competitive with London and with other world cities. The idea for this conference came from Larry Mohn, the president of the Manhattan Institute, who came in one day and said, you know, New York is looking so great, it feels so great, but we also know that New York has many big things it has to do to prepare for the future. And this is an administration that is thinking big ideas, Plan 2030 being a wonderful example of this. It's thinking big ideas. It's as of today, Mayor Bloomberg has 791 days to go. And this is a superb moment to find out from Mayor Bloomberg his big ideas for the future. So please join me in welcoming our mayor.
Thank you. Thank you. Julia, thank you, and good morning to everyone. I see some people are still coming in. The traffic is pretty bad. Somebody's just got to come up with an idea how to solve the traffic problem in this city. Let me first address an issue that I keep getting asked about, and I would ask you to keep this confidential because we really want to have a formal announcement later on. No matter how exciting or challenging any other position might be, I plan to stay as mayor for the next 791 days, and the Yankees are just going to have to look elsewhere for another third baseman. I would have thought I'd got a better laugh than that, but that was actually very clever. Anyways, Let me thank the Manhattan Institute and its president, Larry Mond, not just for bringing us together this morning, but for more than 25 years of scholarship and leadership in reshaping public policy in our wonderful city. On subjects ranging from welfare reform to tax policy, the Manhattan Institute's hard-nosed, well-researched ideas have had a tremendous impact, and I particularly want to thank them for spearheading our movement to ban trans fats. It really was very helpful. Thank you very much. Isn't that a tough crowd? Nowhere has the impact of these ideas been stronger than in the area of policing and public safety, I think it's fair to say. The Manhattan Institute got it exactly right when it argued that low crime was essential to economic growth, neighborhood stability, and a strong and unified city. And by thinking big for New York City, and then by turning that thinking into realistic policy prescriptions, the Manhattan Institute has helped was once written off as an ungovernable city that has put itself right again. Now, we've been in City Hall for almost 6 years, 6 years minus 2 months, and over those 6 years, we have, I think, built on the record that we inherited and kept New York moving forward in directions that the Manhattan Institute has pointed the way on. We've driven crime down by more than 25% lower than it was 6 years ago, while at the same time, sadly, crime is going up in the rest of the country. We've outpaced the nation in moving people from welfare to work, and today the welfare rolls are at a more than 40-year low. We've also brought the principles of welfare reform to the homeless system and freed ourselves, as Julia recently noted in the Post, from the tyranny of the advocates, as she called it, and the fetters of political correctness as we employ new strategies to continue reducing street homelessness in this city. And perhaps most importantly of all, we've brought accountability to our school system, championed charter schools, and created the nation's largest pay-for-performance program for teachers and principals. Not only has the ungovernable city become governable again, we've reclaimed our title as the greatest city on earth. Because the truth is, today, New York City is back. And not just back from the aftermath of 9/11, but from half a century when the city's engine of growth, our population, was essentially stuck in neutral. Today, I'm happy to report that that engine is in high gear. Since 2002, we've gained close to a quarter of a million residents in this city, and we expect our population to climb to 9 million people by the year 2030. Now, that's great news because the ability to attract people and talent is our single biggest predictor of a city's economic success. A major factor in this renewed growth and our economic recovery is an openness to immigrants, and we'll continue to advocate immigration policies that create secure borders for our nation, but also open the door for immigrants who really are the future of our city. Other indicators of our city's growth are just as strong, I'm happy to report. This year, for the third consecutive year, we're on course to issue permits for at least 30,000 housing starts. $10 billion in construction is underway within a three-block radius of the World Trade Center. In fact, our biggest construction problems are what I call problems of success. Not enough vacant land, steel, cement, plumbers, carpenters, iron workers to meet demand. And by every quality of life measure, crime, street cleanliness, park cleanliness and accessibility, school test scores and graduation rates, the city is a more attractive place to live in and invest in than it has been in decades. And we may be headed for a national economic slowdown, and that certainly will affect New York, but I think New York City has probably never been better prepared to weather one than we are right now. 6 years ago, if you remember, no one was predicting that we would be as strong as we are today. Far from it. In the aftermath of 9/11, the conventional wisdom was that New York's best days as a city were probably behind us. When we came into office, the watchword was recovery. If we could somehow manage to stave off the expected exodus of businesses and residents, if we could keep crime down to the levels seen during the Giuliani administration, people would consider it a job well done, and that's what we should shoot for. Not too many people were placing any bets on our hitting even those survival targets. Remember, new administration, untested leaders, companies talking about fleeing our city. But we believe that recovery was not enough, that that was not an acceptable goal, that just getting by was not an acceptable objective for a city as wonderful as we have here, that the past, while good, was not something that we should consider a cap, but rather we should use as a base. And so we came into office determined not to be stewards of history, but rather to be leaders of the promise of America, to achieve not just short-term recovery, but real long-term growth. I spent 15 years on Wall Street and another 20 years up and running the building and running my own company, and I did learn a lot, and I've learned one of the things that's most important. You have to manage for the present, but you have to move forward and build for decades yet to come, and we have been doing exactly both of those things. We began by doing precisely what Julia's Center for Rethinking Development does so insightfully. We asked basic questions about the city's recent past, the present, and its future. The threshold question was, how do we make New York City more competitive? How do we make it attractive to both the enterprises and the people who will give it vitality in this century? And we decided fairly quickly that that meant changing course in a fundamental fashion, and that new course would be set by private investment, not government programs. But the question was, how would we incentivize this investment? And the answer that we arrived at was that we needed to completely rethink the regulations governing the way we use land in this city, to couple that regulatory relief with investments in the public infrastructure and amenities that make communities attractive for private developers, and to get all key city agencies and the principal community stakeholders on board with the process, something that's not always easy to do in this great but sometimes contentious city of ours. Even before we came into office, we were committed to making city regulations supportive of, not deterrence to, private investment. Let me talk a little bit about that. When I ran for mayor in 2001, I promised to modernize the building code, which was adopted in 1968. I did not realize at the time how difficult that would be, which is probably why nobody had done it. But we did work very hard, and Patricia Lancaster, our Buildings Department Commissioner, really does deserve an enormous amount of credit. She does, yes. She brought together everyone, all at the same table, developers and unions, fire and safety professionals, the city council, and she kept them there until every single last detail was hammered out. Now the outdated regulations that were unnecessarily complex and convoluted have been replaced with a streamlined set of codes that will reduce building and construction costs and lead to safer and more energy-efficient buildings. We've also streamlined the development process by assuming responsibility for the environmental reviews associated with rezoning. In the past, these were always the obligation of private developers for their individual projects. Now, I'm not in favor of government doing everything, but I can tell you these reviews can be lengthy, painful, and expensive disincentives to development. And now city planning, led by Amanda Burden, has taken on these reviews and moves them through the process. And that will encourage development and jobs in areas prepared to handle growth. And we'll easily recoup our costs through the resulting new tax revenues. Some people might call this a gift to developers. I just think it's a smart way to do the people's business because development and growth are essential to the future of our city. But the most important regulations that we zeroed in on were our zoning regulations themselves. We knew that New York could not become a 21st century city if it continued operating under a zoning resolution that was adopted in 1961 and really was obsolete by the year 1975. Decades ago, there was a belief, still around today, that with the right zoning, you could preserve a big share of the city's industrial economy. Sadly to report, no such luck. By the early 1970s, we were hemorrhaging blue-collar jobs. By 2002, the city's economy had changed dramatically, but we were penned in by land use restrictions that no longer made any sense. The waterfront piers were nearly empty. the warehouses falling down, the factories closed, but they still stood there. And even though market forces were pressing for housing in these areas, the city's regulations prohibited it. The 1961 zoning regulation did succeed, however, in meeting one of our major goals, encouraging development at the city's periphery, away from mass transit. This is where the planners back then expected the city to grow. Co-op City and Starrett City were seen as the future. But as often the case, government really isn't very adept at predicting the future. Government was making two big mistakes back then. It was freezing out development in areas where growth made sense and sending it to places that didn't have the infrastructure to handle it. And we were determined to change that, to unlock the potential of the city's underused land, to allow market forces to create mixed-use communities while moving away from a Manhattan-centric model of the city's economy. But to do this, we couldn't just change the colors on a zoning map. Oh, if it were that easy. In addition to clearing away regulatory barriers, we also had to clear away a second set of obstacles, physical obstacles. We saw that rezoning had to be coupled with targeted improvements, especially in communities that had long been neglected, because private companies are simply not going to invest in those communities unless the city invests in public infrastructure and amenities. And that means increasing the capacity of sewers, expanding mass transit, improving streetscapes, and creating new parks and open spaces. These are the public goods that catalyze private investment. Let me give you an example. Think about London's Canary Wharf. It was built by the Reichmans on the promise that the government would run the London Tube out to it. And when government failed to do that, Canary Wharf went bankrupt. But when the government finally acted and built the Jubilee Line, the new owners had on their hands one of the most successful real estate deals of all times. Without that tube extension, Canary Wharf might still be bankrupt, and the jobs that are there now would be scattered around the world. Now, we took that lesson to heart, and that's why we didn't wait for the MTA to find the capital dollars to pay for the number 7 train extension into the Hudson Yards. It would have become the next Second Avenue subway, I think, delayed by 50 years. We put up the money, our money. Because without the subway, developers are not going to build office space and housing that we need in the decades to come. And I'm pleased to say that this work is now moving forward. The first contract for constructing the new tunnel has been let, and that's an essential step to creating the modern and readily accessible office space we need to stay competitive in the global environment. If you take a look at the West Side, it is the next Gold Coast of this city. Clearing away regulatory barriers and committing to infrastructure investments, you should note, were the first two big pieces of our land use and rezoning strategy. But the third big piece was just as important, and that was involving the community in the process and getting all the key city agencies to work together as a team. Because if we're going to redraw plans for communities, we should recognize that government doesn't always know what's best, and the community's voices have to be heard. And if we're going to invest in public infrastructure, we had better be sure that we're putting our money in the right places and that all agencies are working together to get it done on time and on budget. Autocratic urban planning has the virtue of speed, but it also leads to arrogant mistakes. If you think back when Robert Moses wanted to level a neighborhood, he just had to send in the bulldozers, and at least 200,000 people were displaced by the urban renewal projects that he started. But that's not the world that we live in anymore. Whether you think he was right or wrong, today really is very different, and I think our work shows it. Both Dan Doctoroff and Amanda Burden really do deserve enormous credit for the way they have worked together with community leaders and built consensus and gotten our rezonings adopted. Just consider this. Since 2002, we've taken 78 rezonings through the ULURP process. And by the way, if anyone knows of a less musical acronym for ULURP, please keep it to yourself. I've figured out what it stands for. We haven't lost a single one of those rezonings. Not one. And this is New York, where if you ask 5 people a question, you will certainly get at least 6 answers, 2 of which will be changed by tomorrow. Reforming regulations, making smart investments, and working collaboratively to make it happen. Those are the elements that really have defined our approach to land use. And I think you can see them all in our recent efforts in Jamaica. Last month, the City Council approved a rezoning covering almost 370 blocks in this part of Southeast Queens, the biggest single rezoning that our administration has done or will do, and one of the largest in the city's history. And the vote was the result of an enormous amount of work. I remember walking into a meeting on Jamaica last July. There were 42 people in the room from 15 different agencies, and each one of them was describing their responsibilities in this community. Sewer upgrades, city improvements, streetscape improvements, extending Atlantic Avenue, building sidewalks and pedestrian walkways, improving street lighting, planting trees, creating additional parking. All of this work, combined with the rezoning, fortunately is going to get done, and it will set the stage for development of 3 million square feet of new office, retail, and hotel space, 9,500 new jobs, and also 5,200 new homes in a community that is superbly served by mass transit. It will clear Jamaica for takeoff as a thriving business district linked to our busiest regional airport. This is the kind of airport business hub that most other cities in the world have, but we don't, and now we are going to. Across the city, we've taken the same approach to creating the conditions for major new infusions of private investment. Hudson Yards will be the future location of 100,000 midtown jobs, 14,000 apartments, and more than 20 acres of new open space. In Greenpoint, Williamsburg, some 2,400 units of new housing are underway or on the way in the areas that were rezoned in 2005, with thousands more to come. In Queens, Long Island City is finally beginning to grow into its potential. So is Flushing. So is downtown Brooklyn and West Chelsea, the home of the High Line. In each of these neighborhoods, the city didn't merely redraw the zoning regulations. We've invested in the public infrastructure that attracts private capital, and we're making these investments based on a vision that is shaped by the community. In every case, we've encouraged growth in areas that have good links to mass transit, a trend that will become more pronounced in the years ahead. In line with that vision, within a few weeks, we'll outline a rezoning recommendation for Coney Island that will take full advantage of the wonderfully redesigned and rebuilt Stillwell Avenue subway station there. And similar rezonings are set for areas of the South Bronx, along 125th Street in Harlem, and Queens West, and St. George on Staten Island. And our Plan YC vision for creating housing for our growing city projects that 95% of that housing will be built within a half a mile of a subway, compared to less than 70% of our housing today. And from Riverdale to Bed-Stuy, and from Massapequa to the south shore of Staten Island, even as we're working to create new housing and commercial opportunities, we're also acting to protect neighborhood quality of life and property values. By fundamentally rethinking how we use our land, we've been able to disprove the conventional wisdom that you can't just get big projects done in this city anymore. When the West Side Sports and Convention Center didn't win Albany legislative approval, it was popular to say that the conventional wisdom was right. But it turns out that it wasn't. Just look around the city. You'll see big things being built in all five boroughs. Not just two new baseball stadiums, one in the Bronx and one in Queens. Not just a new basketball arena and apartment towers in Brooklyn. And not just the historic development of Lower Manhattan. These projects really do form only a small part of a much larger picture. From a distance, they're what jump out to the casual observer. But if you look more closely, you'll see the fine-grained, block-by-block rezoning of communities across the city. Taken individually, some of them may seem relatively small in scale, and they've been reported in the news media, usually treated as neighborhood stories. But here's what those increments add up to. We've secured approval for the rezoning of nearly 6,000 city blocks. That's nearly one-sixth of the area of New York City. More rezoning in the past 6 years than has been achieved since 1961 under the past six mayors combined. When you add in the 18 industrial business zones that we've reserved for manufacturing and warehousing employers throughout the five boroughs, the cumulative impact is even greater. And the result is that since 2002, we've created the capacity for up to 40 million square feet of new commercial development, approximately the equivalent of downtown Houston, and up to 45,000 new houses and apartments, enough to house about 120,000 people. What's more, by 2009, rezonings initiated by our administration will have cleared the tracks for creating tens of thousands more housing units. Now, our rezonings, combined with other regulatory reforms, combined with public infrastructure investments, have helped fuel an incredible construction boom in the city. But the only thing more incredible than the amount of building that is going on is the quality of design that has made New York City the place to work for nearly all of the world's best architects, and that wasn't true before. All great cities have great architecture, and great architecture attracts not only the best and the brightest who want to live among it, but visitors who want to experience it. Frank Gehry, Renzo Piano, Raphael Vignoli, Dillis, Goffredo Renfro, Meyer, Calatrava, Foster. These are just a few of the bright stars in a dazzling constellation of architects working in this city today. And they'll leave an aesthetic legacy that will add value to our economy for decades to come. Doing the hard work on land use to maximize private investment doesn't have the political appeal of cutting taxes, but it can have a far greater economic impact. That does not mean that we can't do both, which is why we've eliminated the city's sales tax on clothes and shoes, and it's why we're working right now to convince Albany to reduce the S corporation tax, which would cut taxes for small businesses. You didn't think I was going to finish a speech in the Manhattan Institute while talking about our tax cut agenda, did you? Come on, I'm not that stupid. Whether it's cutting taxes or modernizing the business code or assuming the burden of environmental reviews or proactively conducting rezonings, we're always working to reduce obstacles that stand in the way of private investment so that New York will continue to grow, continue to change, continue to lead. In closing, I thought I'd leave you with a quote from someone who really does know New York as well as anyone, Pete Hamill. In his book Downtown, Pete wrote, quote, "In New York, the present becomes the past more rapidly than in any other city in the world." When that stops being true, I think it's fair to say New York will cease to be the greatest city on earth. But I can assure you that it is not going to happen on our watch. Our city's future is bright with promise, and New York's best days are still to come. So thank you and enjoy the rest of the program. We are all so lucky to live in the greatest city on earth, and it is going to get greater. Don't listen to the naysayers. God bless.
We'll begin with our panel, Amanda, Felix, and Ken. For a couple minutes, so. Okay. Our first speaker is Kenneth Jackson. Excuse me. Ken is director of the Herbert Lehman Center for the Study of American History and the Jacques Barzin Professor in History and the Social Sciences, Columbia. Ken is also a wildly popular lecturer at Columbia, and he has a famous midnight tour of Manhattan, that a bike ride that goes through Manhattan to Brooklyn at night to avoid the congestion during the day. So I think, Ken, if Mayor Bloomberg's congestion pricing goes through, you'll be able to do this during the day in subsequent years. This is such a popular event, however, that when I Googled Ken, I came across dozens and dozens of comments by former students about this bike ride and its introduction to the to New York and New York neighborhoods, and what a life-changing experience this one course was. Ken recently gave a talk in Westchester that I thought was enormously interesting. He made a point about New York that New York has never had what he called a majority culture. And he said that New Amsterdam was different from all other cities in America because it was founded not by people who were trying to protect their religious beliefs, it was founded by people who were interested in commerce. So the very basis of New York from the beginning was trade. And he said the pursuit of prosperity enhances tolerance. It turns out that the peak immigrant year in Ellis Island, according to Ken, was 1907, right. So this must be the 100th anniversary of the peak immigration to Ellis Island, but I haven't actually seen that celebrated anyplace. Right. So we've asked Ken, as a historian, to talk about the big ideas of the past and which of these ideas made New York great and which are relevant for us today and what they have to say about New York's future. So, please, Professor Jackson.
When Julia asked me to say a few words, I wondered why I was speaking in such august company with Mayor Bloomberg and Amanda Burden and Felix Roetten. And after all, I'm a boy from the South, from Memphis, Tennessee. But then I was told secretly the reason was because I'd been teaching New York City history so long and was so old that I'd actually seen most of it and therefore could comment. I will be brief. Maybe a quarter century or so ago, I was asked to put together a list of or an article on the dozen decisions that had changed New York. And when Julia asked me to do this, I thought briefly about that list and then thought I didn't have the time to do that in 8 minutes. I'll just run through it quickly. And you can think of another dozen, I'm sure, that would be different. Mine were the English capture of New York in 1664, which changed the name and the direction, created something like the mayor. The adoption of the grid system in 1811, which, like it or not like it, it's one evidence of how important history is. When they decided streets would be 60 feet wide every 200 feet and the avenues would be 800 feet apart, and that every street that Broadway crisscrossed as it angled northwestward would be where the streets would be wider, so that we knew long before there was such a thing as 23rd or 34th or 42nd or 72nd or 79th, long before those became subway stops, that they would be wider and they'd be two-way streets now. The institution of packet service in New York, regularly scheduled boat service, which is taken for granted today on airplanes and everything else, but it was a new concept when New Yorkers introduced it. The opening of the Erie Canal in 1825, which most important public works project in American history before the Interstate Highway Program. The opening of the Croton Aqueduct in 1842, which gave New York City what is still the greatest water system of any big city in the world, and which is essentially mountain water brought to you by a system of aqueducts and reservoirs. The building of Central Park in the late 1850s, the most important open space in the world, not because it's the biggest, not because it's the most beautiful, and not because it's the largest, most beautiful or oldest, but because it had the greatest influence on the rest of the nation. the consolidation of the city in 1898, the brainchild of Andrew Haspel Green, which created the city. And one of the things I think we should stop saying in New York is that the city has 8 million people or 9 million people. They never say that in Atlanta or Houston or other cities. They give the metropolitan population. We should say we have 8 million. We actually have 22 million people because that's the world that you're up against in other cities. They don't use the city population. The consolidation in 1898 did give New York temporarily a metropolitan population when Brooklyn and Queens and Staten Island and the Bronx become part of the city. Technically, it's not all exactly 1898, but it's not important. The adoption of the tenement house law in 1901, so that even today when we talk about old law and new law tenements, we're talking about the legislation of 1901, which essentially outlawed the dumbbell tenement. The opening of the subway in 1904, it's not as old as London in 1863 or Budapest or Boston, but on the day it opened, it became the most important subway in the world and the busiest, and it was so until certainly the 1960s, and even now, in many respects, it's the most important and busiest subway in the world. Moscow has a few more passengers. You could argue the details. The adoption of comprehensive zoning in 1916. Mayor Bloomberg just talked about changes to it, but when it starts in New York in 1916, trying to push the garment district west of 7th Avenue, opening up the limitations on skyscrapers, more or less building New York different from Chicago and other cities, it dates from 1916. It has an enormous impact on the city. The coming to power of Robert Moses, as Mayor Bloomberg says, love him or hate him, Robert Moses was such an important influence on the city. The building of Rockefeller Center into the 1920s, early 1930s. And if I'd written the article later, probably the saving of the city through the Municipal Assistance Corporation and the figuring out a way to finance the city through that financial crisis in 1974 and 75, in which Lou Rudin and our panelist Felix Rohatyn had such a major responsibility and to whom we owe such a great debt. But I don't really want to talk about those because they could, first of all, we could think of another dozen. But I did want to think, what is the fundamental characteristic of New York? And if we could just really boil it down to a few things. And these are the things I would say. First of all, diversity begins on the first day of New York settlement. It's been different from every other city in the world from day one, in the sense that the Dutch were not interested in creating a homogeneous community, but in trading. The Dutch famously had more than 18 languages being spoken here in the 1630s when there were fewer than 1,000 people. It was not an homogenous society. It still is not. In 2000, New York had 2.9 million foreign-born, even though London claims it's the most diverse. It only has 2.2 million, and they count people from Wales and Scotland as people from somewhere else. And we don't count all those illegal immigrants who are no doubt holed up in Queens and other places. So I think in diversity, there is no other city. And even though Miami has 60% foreign-born, which is more than we do in Miami or Los Angeles and so many other cities, that's from one or two places, you can't think of an ethnic group. Did the Encyclopedia of New York City. We have an entry on every immigrant group, even the Estonians. There are not as many Estonians completely as they are in just the Upper East Side, but there's an Estonian house in New York City. Toleration. While I know that individually we're probably no more tolerant than anybody else in the world, there is a kind of forced toleration by the crowdedness and the density of the city that's been here from the beginning. The Dutch probably started it by accepting, first of all, Jewish settlers in Amsterdam in the 17th century and before, and New Amsterdam follows suit in 1654, not just with the Jewish population, but with Quakers soon after that, and the Flushing Remonstrance that's coming up later in this year, that 350th anniversary, which sets the agenda for religious freedom in the United States. Thirdly, density. Except for Hoboken, which is a special case, New York is and always has been the most densely settled place in the United States, approximately twice as dense as Chicago or more than that of Philadelphia or every other city, as any six-year-old girl could tell you by looking out the window of a car. That really is the signature of New York City. If you want a lot of grass and you want a lot of space, this is not your spot. Fourthly, and I think maybe most important in the context of this morning's discussion, the ability to change and to face the future with confidence and hope. And I mean change in several respects. First, to welcome new immigrant groups, not just the Dutch and English and French and others who were first here, but the Italians and the Puerto Ricans and the Russians and the Asians who have come later. So that while we know it's not an easy city, and we often ask ourselves, why do the Arabs and Muslims drive all the taxis in New York? Did somebody forget to tell them this is the largest Jewish city in the world? But the truth is that we believe in New York that we really don't care. And in the not giving a damn is a freedom to be whatever you can be. So it's not gracious as it is in Memphis, but it's accepting as it is not in Memphis and in other cities. And that's the secret of New York. It's the welcoming of a change in the sense of the change in the economy. As Mayor Bloomberg asserted, New York has completely been revolutionized a number of times, but just think in our lifetime. As late as the 1950s, it wasn't just a manufacturing city. It was the most important manufacturing city in the world as late as the 1950s. It wasn't just a busy harbor. It was the busiest harbor in the world in the 1950s. And I'm showing a movie tonight in class called On the Waterfront, which, as you remember, picks up the harbor in 1954 and shows it when there were the thousands of stevedores unloading boxes and bags, and all those tens of thousands of jobs in New Jersey and Staten Island and Brooklyn and Manhattan docks. And they're gone. The manufacturing jobs, 80% of them, 85% of them are gone. And as Mayor Bloomberg said, still those factories and warehouses were sitting around. And the port is gone, partly because of the rise of the Pacific Rim and mostly because of containers. It's still a major world port. But we're never going to have hundreds of thousands of jobs belonging to it. But New York has reinvented itself. And I think change in accepting a new physical reality. We are seeing now the reinvention of the city, the rezoning of the city under Commissioner Burden and others. And it is a revolution. But we need to remember that even now New York is not changing as much as its competitors. Shanghai has changed more in the last 10 years than New York's changed in the last 100. Tokyo and Taipei and Seoul and Singapore have done the same, and even London has changed rapidly. We need to be open to change. We need to realize that the real tradition of New York City, the real history of New York City, is not expressed in bricks and mortar, but in change and accepting. When the Woolworth Building was built in 1911 to 1913, it changed the streetscape. It's now considered one of the grandest buildings ever built. When the Empire State Building replaced the Waldorf Astoria at 34th and 5th, it changed the streetscape quite a bit and is now recognized as an icon around the world. When Rockefeller Center was built in the early 1930s, it required the destruction of dozens of what were at the time very attractive structures. Rockefeller Center is now considered one of probably the most important public open spaces on earth. I would suggest that we are in competition with Tokyo and Shanghai and Beijing and Seoul and London to be the greatest city in the world. Not with Boston or Philadelphia or Newport or Charleston, to be the place with the most historic structures and the most gracious streets. That is, Mayor Bloomberg said, we need to plan for the decades to come. We need to be open to change. Years ago, I was asked in Elfinhead, who was the great mayor of New York City? And when you say the great mayor of New York City, typically you mean Fiorello LaGuardia, who was elected in 1933 and really served through 1945, the little flower. He was a one-man melting pot. You know, his father was Italian, his mother was Catholic, he was an Episcopalian, he spoke all sorts of languages. He seemed to epitomize in one person the character and soul of the city and carried it through the Great Depression. And more recently, I think Edward Koch gets respect for the way in which he at least gave the impression, beginning in the late 1970s when New York City was at its nadir, that he was pleased and proud and anxious to be the mayor of New York City, and he was going to do it and take responsibility. And while A lot of indices did not improve, especially crime, during the Koch administration. I do think there was a kind of turnaround in the quality of leadership at the time. And again, love him or hate him, we all have to admit that under Mayor Giuliani, the image of New York City improved, not just in the suburbs, but around the nation. And the drop in crime, whether it was his doing or Comstock or the passing of the crack epidemic or the incarceration of more people or neighborhood policing or whatever it was, some part of it has to land on him. So that probably the three most influential mayors of the 20th century were Fiorello LaGuardia and Edward Koch and Rudolph Giuliani. I think it may not be too early to say, though, that it looks like Mayor Bloomberg will one day be remembered as the greatest mayor New York City has ever had. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken. I actually want to give a little ad for Ken. As I think everybody in the room knows, Ken had been the editor of the Encyclopedia of New York, which was a magnificent achievement. And more recently, I gather this is somehow part of the same enterprise. Ken's group has been putting out a series of volumes on the neighborhoods of New York. The most recent is this one, The Neighborhood of Queens. And,
so new, I haven't seen it yet myself.
Oh, you haven't? Oh, well.
I,
there you go.
It just came out.
Yes, it just came out. And, you know, the neighborhood is New York's basic unit. And I was at a conference last night sponsored by the Municipal Arts Society on Jane Jacobs, and there was a great deal of sort of academic discussion about the difference between Jacobs and Moses. But the thing that Jacobs stood for that's so immensely important is that she loved and respected New York neighborhoods. Our next speaker, Amanda Burden, who is the chair of the New York City Planning Commission and the director of the Department of City Planning, is also a lover and respecter of New York neighborhoods. Someone who's immensely knowledgeable about New York neighborhoods. Most of her career has been involved with New York neighborhoods one way or another, and not just the elegant neighborhoods of Manhattan. Amanda was head of design for Battery Park City for many years, but all of the boroughs. Amanda, for example, was very active in the Community Justice Center in Red Hook, Brooklyn. And Amanda is now in charge of one of the most important initiatives of the Bloomberg administration, the rezoning of large swaths of New York. So welcome, Amanda.
Technological adjustments here. While we're setting up, I just want to thank Julia and the Manhattan Institute for hosting this event and recognizing the importance of planning and zoning to New York City's future. I also want to take this opportunity to thank the mayor. We have a mayor who has a vision for the entire city, understands that we need development in the city, it needs to grow. We need to create housing and jobs for all New Yorkers. But the mayor also recognizes the importance and the richness of our diverse neighborhoods and how important it is to protect the quality of the neighborhoods. In addition to that, recognize the importance of quality open space and recapturing our waterfront, and it is really a privilege and honor to work for him and under the leadership of Deputy Mayor Dan Doktoroff. And while we're setting up, what I wanted to show you, if it's getting set up, just to walk you briefly through two of our rezoning initiatives to show you how we catalyze development and attract private sector investment. And as the mayor mentioned, what we do at City Planning, we take it upon us, upon the public sector, to pay for to go through the tedious environmental review than to build consensus in neighborhoods, in communities, take the entire rezoning through the City Planning Commission and through the City Council, and to get those rezonings adopted into law. To date, we have rezoned 88 neighborhoods of the city, as the mayor said, one-sixth of the city, and all of those rezonings have channeled growth to transit-rich areas to make it sustainable development and channel growth away from auto-dependent neighborhoods. And I'm going to, as soon as we're set up, I'm going to take you through. There we go. I think we're almost ready. Just two projects to show you how we catalyze an area and attract public investment into areas that have really been neglected for a long time. I have to get it up on the screen. Okay. So, and I just want to know where the pointer is. Yeah, here, this is there. Sorry, is it working? Our very first was downtown Brooklyn. As the mayor mentioned, one of the chief focuses was a five-borough economic policy. And you'll see in your folders all of the rezonings that have been adopted. They're a five-borough initiative. And we focused also on regional business districts, wanted to catalyze development in each district so that each district could, the entire city could capture our share of the region's growth. Downtown Brooklyn, this is a great opportunity for a regional business district. It had great neighborhoods, Fort Greene, Borham Hill, Brooklyn Heights, right next to Lower Manhattan, right across the bridge, one subway stop, but nobody wanted to go there. It was not only underzoned, but the streetscape, the whole pedestrian realm, was really miserable. So not only was it underzoned, but it had a terrible street environment. And on the weekends, nobody was there, no retail, not a good place, not a place to attract a corporate headquarters. So we looked to rezone, not only upzone downtown Brooklyn, to bring to it a sense of vibrancy, to bring a mixed-use, modern business district that has housing, that has shops, that has retail. So upzoning was our first objective. But this is the traditional methodology of what we would present to a community to build consensus for a rezoning initiative. This is not only incomprehensible, even to me, but it was incomprehensible to communities and quite frightening. You're not going to get a significant upzoning and use this as your consensus-building document. So what we do in every one of our initiatives is to draw the zoning, draw what it will look like. And I don't have the pointer to actually show you there, but the avenue that runs diagonal is Flatbush Avenue. You're looking from the area of the Brooklyn Bridge South. This is how we drew downtown Brooklyn. The buildings in blue are commercial office buildings centered around both Willoughby Street and about Borham Place and Adams Street. A mixed-use district. Channel development right around the transit infrastructure. Downtown Brooklyn has fantastic transit infrastructure. We could build on the strengths of MetroTech and the universities that are there, Polytech and CUNY. Build on that strength, always building on the strength of what's there. Recognizing the adjoining neighborhoods. You see Fort Greene on your left, Borham Hill on the top, Brooklyn Heights is to your right. In the rezoning, draw it. Recognize we understand that these neighborhoods are low scale. So you actually transition down from high density around the business district, mixed-use business district, to the adjoining neighborhoods. And very, very, very important, public open space, a network of public open space to change the perception of the area and attract investment. Very, very important. So this was the image that we used to build consensus for the downtown Brooklyn plan. We always, transit infrastructure being key, this is the new transit hub at J Street, which the MTA is building to handle this development. At Willoughby Street, the city is investing, again, invest in public open space to change the perception of an area and attract public investment. This is a new square that the city is building, a public square at Willoughby Street with a public garage underneath it. This will create an address for Willoughby Street and attract investment there. This is the new Flatbush Avenue. Flatbush Avenue, as you know, is a divider right now. This is the new Flatbush Avenue. We're putting a median in the middle, planting trees on either side of Flatbush Avenue so that Flatbush Avenue can be a magnificent gateway to Brooklyn. Not a divider, but a real connector. As you see on the left of the screen, these are apartment buildings. There are already 14 complete or in construction. There are 56 new initiatives, planning initiatives, construction initiatives in downtown Brooklyn, 5 already in construction on around Willoughby Street, and 12 around the Livingston-Skermerhorn State Street corridor. This is downtown Brooklyn. This is on the upper right. This is the new Marriott. Lower left, Smith Street apartment house. Lower left, Courtin Atlantic Street and Skermerhorn Street apartments. This kind of approach yields results. 56 projects in downtown Brooklyn from not only the rezoning, but coupled with public investment in public open space and in the context of an urban design master plan. Let me take you through the next project, perhaps one of my favorites, and it's not my favorite. This is West Chelsea. This was in 2002, all zoned for manufacturing, a great place to incentivize residential development. And weaving through it was an extraordinary piece of public infrastructure, the High Line, which connects the meat market all the way with Hudson Yards. It's an amazing structure, but in the last administration was perceived of as a blight upon the neighborhood. The mayor saw it another way. The mayor saw it as a defining element that could catalyze investment, private investment, that could really create a new district that had as its armature this incredible piece of public infrastructure that had turned magically into a garden in the sky. We had a challenge, however, because this elevated rail line was controlled by the federal government, and the federal government would not turn it over to the city unless we had the signature of all 38 property owners who were leading the opposition, who were leading the desire for demolition. And until they had signed on, we could not have this transferred from the federal government to the city. And they had a point. They own land under and adjacent to the High Line, and they could not realize the value of their property. So zoning to the rescue. We devised a special district, and if you can look very carefully, I can't point at it, you see the High Line towards the middle of this section. The yellow box shows there the property owners, the property adjacent or underneath the High Line. We devised a special district to channel development to the right and the left to 10th and 11th Avenue, restricting a height, those heights, until and unless those developers on the avenues bought the development rights from the property owners under and adjacent to the High Line. Our rezoning is always block by block, street by street, lot by lot. We have very carefully devised urban design controls to ensure variety of building type and, most importantly, light and air onto the High Line. The rezoning district stretches from 16th Street all the way up to 30th Street. You can see on this axonometric channeling development to 11th and to 10th and 11th Avenues. Very important part of this initiative was to recognize one of the great assets of this area, the city's premier art gallery district. So we kept the center area, which is still beige, as manufacturing to preserve the art gallery district. And of course, this rezoning catalyzed the transformation of the High Line. Coupled with our rezoning, always, investment in public open space. The city is investing $100 million in the High Line Park. And this is going to be one of the most unusual, unique, and magnificent parks in the country, if not in the world. It will provide an image of the city from a vantage point you will see from no other place. My partner and leader in this effort, Adrian Benepe, the Parks Department, the Friends of the High Line, are shepherding this design and effort. We are in construction, going to be opening next year, next fall. It's an amazing effort. It will be open in some places, verdant in others, and it is going to have a transformative effect. But it has already had an informative, transformative effect. Because on this length of the High Line, from the rezoning in the anticipation of this incredible new park, we have already 30 new developments along this corridor that was once perceived as a blighting element on this neighborhood. On the left slide are just some of the architects who are coming from all over the world, clamoring to build around the High Line. Top left, we have a incredible Annabelle Seldorf building, Audrey Matlock on the bottom, and on the right side, a new tower by Jean Nouvel. This is going to be one of the most exciting districts in the entire city. And again, through zoning, careful planning, lot by lot, and through public investment in the infrastructure in the context of an urban design master plan. What's next? Very quickly, some major projects. We only have 791 days to go. We are very mindful. We have very short time. In public review now, rezoning for Harlem's Main Street, 125th Street. Zoning will catalyze the development of 125th Street into a great regional business district. Again, great transit infrastructure, a fabulous place to have a regional business district centered on its heritage, arts, culture, and entertainment. In the Bronx, the South Bronx. This is definitely the decade of the South Bronx, the year of the South Bronx. Investment in the South Bronx is fantastic. We are focusing now on the 161st Street corridor, which is the Yankee Stadium corridor from 3rd Avenue to Yankee Stadium. Fantastic place for civic, commercial, and residential development. The lower concourse, building on our success in Port Morris, has fantastic loft buildings, access to the waterfront. This rezoning will catalyze over 3,000 units in the South Bronx. Coney Island, the mayor mentioned that very soon. The mayor will be announcing a comprehensive plan to save the amusement park, which is beloved and iconic in all of our minds, not our minds not alone, but in the entire world. Coney Island represents one of the most democratic and populous places on earth, and it is beloved by the entire world. This strategy will save the amusements, will catalyze investments in a new park, in a park which will be year-round, understanding that it has to be coupled with retail and entertainment and housing as well in the right location. And I would say one of the most complex and important projects this administration will undertake in partnership with the state of New York and the railroads is the transformation of Penn Station and the Farley Building into a magnificent transit hub and making a great civic place and a transportation network and an expansion of Midtown so that this can be a real gateway to the Hudson Yards. We're not stopping there. These are initiatives, a list of the initiatives that we'll be undertaking in the next 2 years. We will touch virtually every neighborhood of the city. We will ensure that growth is channeled where transit infrastructure is rich to ensure that we make New York City healthy, livable, sustainable, and competitive city over the next century. Thank you very much.
In 1975, when New York City was facing bankruptcy and looking into the abyss, Felix Roatan figured out a complex rescue structure and drove his rescue through multiple levels of government and hundreds of private partners and opponents until he succeeded in financially rescuing New York. New York today would just not be the immensely successful city it is without the magnificent achievements of Felix and his band of brothers, Hugh Carey, Victor Gottbaum, and many others. And I think it's also fair to say New York would not be the city it is today without the Koch administration, because even as Felix and the Municipal Assistance Corporation were rescuing New York financially, tens of thousands of housing units were converting to city ownership through tax foreclosure. And over the three terms of the Koch administration, housing officials and Mayor Koch gradually figured, they tried everything, and gradually figured out how to get this catastrophic amount of property back on the road anyway, to being back on the tax rolls, which all of it is today. From 1975 to 1993, Felix Roatan was chairman of the Municipal Assistance Corporation. He served as U.S. Ambassador to France from 1997 until 2000. Today, he is senior advisor to Lehman Brothers. He was born in Vienna, so he is an immigrant, and we have asked Felix, an esteemed immigrant, to talk about New York and its status as a world city and competition with other cities. So please join me in welcoming Felix.
Thank you very much. I got a phone call yesterday from somebody, a reporter of Business Week, and he asked me if I was aware of the fact that Mac had tendered whatever legal document was necessary to announce that they were going out of business next year under the rules set by the law that created Mac. And I hadn't paid much attention to when and how Mac was going to go out of business. But I was thrilled to hear that, because it meant that not only had we been successful in borrowing a lot of money, but that we were also successful in paying it all back, which is really the purpose of a vehicle like Mac. But it is, you just cannot talk enough about the people who in 1975 were involved in this exercise, beginning with Governor Hugh Carey, then with Ed Koch, Victor Gottbaum, the bank presidents, and ultimately even, although much to his dismay, I think, because he originally certainly didn't want to help us, was President Gerry Ford, who ultimately did come through when the President of France, Mr. Giscard d'Estaing, and the Chancellor of Germany told him that to let the city of New York go bankrupt would be madness. So they finally acquiesced in something that should never have been a real issue in the first place. I'm a refugee, and I came to New York in 1942. And I was born in Vienna, we lived in France, we went to North Africa, we went to South America, and we finally came here. And my family went back to Europe, and I stayed here, which was probably one of the very few very smart things that I did in my life. But New York was always my home, really. And I ultimately only really felt like a New Yorker after having spent a lot of time with the Municipal Assistance Corporation, because it is a special place, and Mac was a special place. When Governor Carey asked me to take the chairmanship of Mac, which was in May 1975, I didn't have a clue about municipal finance, about anything having to do with the politics of New York City. And I asked for advice from a friend of mine, Bob Strauss, who was then the head of the Democratic Party. And he said, oh, Phil, you should do this. It'll take you a couple of weeks, and you'll meet some very interesting people. And you'll have a great time, so go ahead and do it. So I said, yes, I would do it, Governor. And about 3 years later, I really was getting very tired of having to do this. And I finally found Bob Strauss in a restaurant in Paris. And he clearly had a wonderful dinner. And I said, how could you do this to me? You told me, you know, 2 weeks, it's been 3 years, and I'm not finished. He said, Roatan, saving New York City is like making love to a gorilla. He said, you don't stop when you're tired, you stop when he's tired. New York never got tired. But it's been a fabulous experience, and I think we all learned things about how to deal with a crisis like New York City's crisis. And obviously, step number one is to have a great political leader, because without that, nothing can be done. And Hugh Carey was such a political leader, a man of humor, a man of intelligence, a man of great breadth. And the other thing that he had a working relationship with a leading Republican in the Senate, Warren Anderson. So we had bipartisan leadership. We had business-labor cooperation because Victor Gottbaum and Walter Wriston, much to everybody's surprise, got along very well, in addition to Jack Beagle, Barry Feinstein, Sandy Feldman, and the union leaders. Because, again, you cannot do anything unless you have business and labor cooperating with each other and recognizing that they had common interest, and the common interest was the survival of the city of New York. I never made an ultimatum in my life during these negotiations. I never said, listen, unless you do this, we're going to do that. But I always said, listen, here are options, and here is what I think, but it's up to you to decide. It's your pension funds, it's your city, et cetera. And finally, we were able to get it done, and we were able to get it done also by finally getting the President of the United States to sign on to a plan which, without the plan, we would have gone bankrupt. And not only would the city have gone bankrupt, but the state would have gone bankrupt, which nobody really paid much attention to at that time. Now, we've inherited one of the precious things that we found during this period, which is to have a great political leader, and I think that Mike Bloomberg is such a great political leader, partly because he's hugely smart and he's courageous, but he puts in great people like Amanda and Dan Doktoroff, which is the other obvious but clear success of his administration, is the quality and the talent of the people that he has put in there. Now, I came back from Paris actually soon after 9/11. And I never thought the city would recover quickly. I thought, my God, this is going to take years because the morale of the city will be shot and because people are going to leave. But lo and behold, Mike Bloomberg came along and brought the city back with his spirit, with his brains, with his vision. And today, in terms of our place in the world, the city is clearly number one in terms of financial capital that's being created here. Even though we have competition from London, we have competition from Shanghai, we're going to have competition from Beijing. We are the leaders in gastronomy, which, you know, people don't pay much attention to that, and I probably won't be allowed back in France, but I do think that we have the greatest restaurant city in the world. We are the luxury capital of the world. There isn't a single luxury store or brand or anything that you don't find here on Fifth Avenue. Not that it's very economical, but it is a big business, and it identifies the city. We should be the language capital of the world in terms of education, because we are the language capital of the world in terms of the number of people who speak a number of languages. And I think that our universities should make an effort, actually, to make the city the intellectual language capital of the world, because, for among other reasons, I think business all over the world is going to require enormous support in teaching their executives languages. So this is pretty much the way I see it. I think that competition is going to be fierce, because cities, which are almost countries all over the world, are becoming huge and have produced, creating an enormous amount of capital. which they will invest, and they will be very competitive. And with the dollar as cheap as it is, the inflows of foreign capital are going to continue enormously strongly. But the position of the city is going to depend to some extent on the ability of our national government to maintain the dollar as the reserve as the reserve currency of the world. Because if we lose that position, then some of these other positions may erode. I don't think that's going to happen, but if we keep this way, it is likely that it might happen. What's more to say about New York? You can go on saying about New York all the time that it's the best, it's the biggest, it's the loudest, it's a city that really lives 24 hours a day. When you go to other big cities in the world, they don't live 24 hours a day. And it is. If we could only get a good sports team, it would make my happiness complete. In any case, I want to thank Julia for having invited me. I want to thank all of you. I want to thank again for the memory of Mac, which was certainly the greatest experience I ever had. And I wish you a wonderful day. Thank you.
We're going to open the panel to questions. Michael has a microphone, so please identify. I'll call on you. Please identify.